Well, it seems like only yesterday I was seeing you as bright, sparkling first years, becoming the first set of students who were doing reporting continuity and change for me for the last time. And here we are now, you're set and ready for the second half of your degree, because you're over the halfway mark now, and you're now into the final three terms, which is great, fantastic. And it's good to know that you realise that I always like to start promptly at 10 o'clock, which is pretty much fine. A few sort of general things. I'll go over the main handbook, module handbook, and some of the fine details of this in seminars. So one group will have me immediately after this in MB1003, and the other group, I think, are on Thursday. We have two seminar groups from that point of view. So that's all sorted through. First general question. Does anybody know that gentleman there? Martina. Yes, or is it Gary Oldman? I don't know. These days it's difficult to tell. Anybody seen the Gary Oldman movie? Darkest Hour? It's worth seeing. We came in today. Is this your first lecture back, your first official lecture back of second year? You haven't done anything before that? Right. Came today probably looking at the weather thinking, fantastic. Isn't it wonderful? Glorious. You come in here, you see a whole group of chairs, sand scattered around the whole thing, think, what's it all about? Why are we doing this? What's the purpose of everything? And actually, that's very much the case that was the situation post-war Britain for a long period of time, actually for about 10 years. We'd won the war. We were told we'd won the war, Britain had won the war in 1945. It was a success. And yet it didn't feel like that. It felt grey, it felt muggy, it felt miserable, really. And the Second World War, in terms of cost alone, was very expensive. 500,000 people died. It created a huge national debt. Hands up if anybody saw Dunkirk. Yeah. Well, you got a flavour of Christopher Nolan's incarnation there of just how close to complete disaster the country came. And disaster obviously being huge ideological change. And if it hadn't been for America effectively stepping in to support the Allies, for which they charged a substantial fee, which we just actually finished paying off at the start of this century, we basically would have had problems. The Americans charged us to come in to help us in the Second World War. Yes, they did, massively. Massive interest rates. They don't just sort of ship stuff over for nothing. So actually, what else have you actually got at the start of the second, or the end of the Second World War, the start of what we refer to as the post-war period? You've got a huge national debt. Massive. The country is effectively living beyond its means. That whole notion, which again we've heard echoed in the 21st century of having a massive debt, is very much to the fore. The infrastructure, which had been established by the Victorians, which had been worked on by the Edwardians, which had been knocked fairly vigorously by the First World War, had effectively crumbled. Factory equipment was worn out, it was outmoded, and the remaining factory equipment that hadn't been bombed and destroyed effectively just had to make do and mend because there was no money to actually repair anything. So again, a very bleak scenario. Flip side, and this is one of the things that we'll be constantly looking at over this module, in the United States, everything's wonderful. They've got the atom bomb, they've got a consumer society. The confidence is booming. Overseas markets are being swallowed up by basic sort of being sold brand American material, again, to support its own spending power. And as a result of that, it was very difficult for Europeans to actually compete in any way, shape, or form. Now, Britain itself was still arguably a superpower. It did have prestige. It pretty soon was not going to have an empire. Although at this particular moment in time, 45, 46, you know, approximately 70, 80 years ago, it did actually have a military presence in over 40 countries, but it didn't have any money to back it up. Hence this special relationship, which of course has been bonded now with Theresa May and Donald Trump, the special relationship between the United States and Britain. And again, it was predicated on finance. The United States actually not only gave us a big loan during the war to actually support the battle against Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and indeed the Japanese Axis powers, but it effectively propped up the British economy. Now, was this a just no worries, have it interest-free, etc.? No. The return was that America effectively demanded unequivocal support on foreign policy issues. And we'll see as we head through this first lecture how there's an incident in the 1950s that really occurs that shakes people's confidence in terms of that as well. Now, inevitably, that new relationship with America, good grief, they used to be one of our colonies before 1776, of course, and the Declaration of Independence. That was inevitably going to have a massive impact on British culture, particularly on youth culture, which again is something else we'll start talking about and looking at in this particular module. So that's a kind of broad brushed out situation of how the VFOC victory sign that we see there is kind of being predicated. And it's fair to say that that glow of victory after the war probably masked just how weak and dependent on the United States that Britain had actually become. Many people actually look back on the Second World War with pride and nostalgia. The country had pulled together. It had stood alone through the darkest hours, and it had proved its worth. Winston Churchill himself gathered a team of historians to write a history of the Second World War, for which he actually won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1956. Now, arguably, this does massage some of the facts. It was a bestseller, and it also helped to reinforce this notion of wartime courage and morality, which people would say that's what it means to be British. That's representative of the British character. We call this module The Origins of Modern Britain. We hear a great deal about what do we mean by being British and so on. And inevitably, in popular culture, people were constantly being reminded of the war through books, through films, through characters in comics, through toys, even in the late 50s, through television documentaries. And all of these images begin to weave a mythical story. A war of heroes, a people's war. Excellent book, which is well worth looking for this, is a Sunday Times top 10 bestseller by Simon Garfield, Our Hidden Lives, the remarkable diaries of post-war Britain. And this is actually a collection of essays written by people at the time who were working for a project called the Mass Observation Project, which originally started pre-war in the 1930s in Bolton, where people actually wanted to find out how did, you know, the working class live? How did they actually work through that whole process? And Harrison and Humphrey Jennings, I recall back in the days of the documentary filmmakers, were very keen to find out what were ordinary people doing at that particular time. But inevitably, if you cast your mind back, if you talk possibly to grandparents, if you're connected within British culture and so on, living in the 50s was fairly dull and it was fairly stifling. We were also living with the threat of imminent nuclear destruction, as you can see by looking at some of the movies at the time, which effectively meant that with the power of the bomb, once the Russians got hold of the bomb as well, there's a notion that at any particular moment in time, the big red button will be pushed. Sound familiar? And inevitably, you also get a whole notion of a different take on the world. This sense of mass communications is very much evolving. And there's a clash of mainstream culture and counterculture, which kind of reaches a peak, in the 1960s, probably because the youth effectively of the day were rebelling or wanting to rebel against this romanticising of the Second World War and its consequences. Rationing actually continued for a decade after the Second World War had actually ended in Britain. Decade, 10 years, you know, it was eased off slightly for the coronation in 1953, but even that's 8 years, where you still actually have to save your coupons if you want to actually purchase things like sugar, butter, milk, lard, etc., etc. Inevitably, after the war in 1945, there was a sense that the people of Britain wanted to have some kind of payback for their wartime efforts. The government had actually kept morale high with promises of a better world, a new Jerusalem, and it was a coalition government, inevitably. And expectations were high that whether the country was broke or not, it could actually deliver. And curiously, this is one of the reasons why Churchill was booted out at the immediate post-war election after in 1945-46, and the first ever Labour Party government was elected to office with the Prime Minister, Clement Attlee. It's well worth noting this particular image of Time magazine, where you actually see Attlee with the British symbol of the lion, the monarchy and so on, but the lion is crawling across very carefully a tightrope. Is it wishful thinking, or is it just a delicate way in which you actually see this particular image being put together by Time again? Obviously, an American weekly newspaper still with us today. But again, that image that's coming through with the purpose. The Labour Party, and latterly the Labour government, had actually promised jobs, it had promised housing, it had promised a national health service, and it had promised other public services. It won in 1945 with a 146-seat majority. So it was a landslide by any sort of stretch of the imagination. 146 seats majority actually brought the Labour Party to power. And as a result of that, the new Prime Minister, Clement Attlee, managed to carry through an immense legislative programme which incorporated the things I've noted there. The National Insurance Act of 1946, the NHS Act, National Health Service, also 1946, and actually, the National Assistance Act of 1948 created the framework for what we now see effectively as the welfare state. Maybe see it being dismantled as the welfare state. Fuel, power, transport, the Bank of England were all nationalised, again with the intention of creating full employment. Great, it's a brave new dawn. Unfortunately, financially, the books didn't balance. And Britain continued to import more goods than she exported, which led in 1947 to a major currency crisis, which then led in 1949 to the devaluing of sterling against other currencies. That effectively translated to higher prices and cuts to public spending. And rationing, as I'd maintained, also was very much part of that whole process. So you have a situation where your average family could go to the cinema to watch the Hollywood materials, could actually admire the clothes, the fridges, the lifestyles of what was happening in the United States, but a bit like a child with their nose pressed up against a sweet shop window or a toy shop window, you can't have it. For Britain, this was the age of austerity, with a capital A. The population who had denied themselves pretty much everything during the war effectively had to manage on even less. The government actually set limits on what manufacturers were allowed to sell at home so that they could concentrate on exports. So even if you actually could afford to buy a new car or a washing machine or some white goods, you could only do that by putting your name on a waiting list and then wait for it actually to be manufactured, because the priority was to sell overseas, not to the internal market. So again, problems on all sorts of ways. You couldn't literally just go to your local branch of Argos or John Lewis or whatever and say, I'll have that, etc. Inevitably, that was all very damaging for the Labour government, who pretty quickly lost the middle class vote and the women's vote. They struggled on pretty much from 1947 to 1951 with a much smaller majority, and finally were pushed out of office for 13 years. So this grand sort of notion of things that would be developed kind of fell by the wayside, with their last big initiative being in May to September 1951, and it was the Festival of Britain. This was based on the South Bank in London, and it was intended to bring tourists to the UK to also increase morale, a kind of echoing what had already been a fabulous Crystal Palace exhibition in the 19th century, and very much was a precursor to what Tony Blair was doing with the Millennium Dome, etc., within 2001 and so on. It was this sort of notion of, let's have a festival, let's have a party. It was designed to be a showcase for developments in science, developments in technology, developments in arts, and in industrial design. It ran for 5 months, as I say, May to September 1951, and it was very much seen as a demonstration that slowly but surely Britain was getting back in business. 6 years, of course, after the Second World War had been won. It was very successful. There were over 8 million visitors who actually came to the country to actually see the Festival of Britain. Events were actually held all over the country as part of the festival, and the high point was probably the opening of the Royal Festival Hall with a programme of English music. And there were things that inevitably took place all through the capital. Battersea Park, for instance, had fairground rides and so on. But inevitably, it being Britain, it being British, it had its critics as an event. It actually cost £11 million, which, bearing in mind Britain's times of austerity, was a massive amount to invest in basically a five-month party. It put so much pressure on London's power supply that some parts of London were actually plunged into darkness because they couldn't cope. And the pleasure gardens actually opened late because of go slows and work to rules by construction workers who wanted high rates of pay for delivering their material, etc. And when the Conservatives came in just after the Festival of Britain effectively had shut in October 1951, they effectively let the building that had been done fall to pieces pretty much for a decade, with the main site being used for an office block and a car park. In fact, the only thing that actually remains of the Festival of Britain is this thing on the South Bank, which if you've ever visited it, you might recall that's kind of the notion of there. Again, another critic, compare this concrete brutalist architecture, this slab of concrete, with the notion of the Houses of Westminster and so on. That building, the Royal Festival Hall, was very much perhaps seen as a symbol of the new world to follow. It was modern, it was austere, it was concrete, and it was fairly brutalist in terms of what folk were looking at and so on. Now, the Tories came back to office on a promise of prosperity and cutting bureaucracy. Oh, sounds familiar. But it actually took them around 10 years to actually achieve the free market consumer paradise that middle-class Americans were actually enjoying. Why? Because rationing was continuing, and continued, as I said, until 1954. Spam was very much to the fore. Spam, spam, and more spam. And children would actually play on bomb sites. Families would be struggling to cope with inadequate housing. Life was dull and boring for most. But on the plus side, at least there wasn't any war. So you weren't likely to be bombed on a regular basis. You just had to work in areas that had been bombed, as these little souls were sort of saying. Health and safety. Also, you could argue that there were plenty of jobs. Life overall was secure. And in fact, the number of jobs is particularly significant when we go on to consider the immigration issues that started working through that. There were also, thanks to the NHS Act, plenty of healthcare, and indeed pensions were actually there as well. Looking at some of the figures for, again, this demolition process that the National Socialist Party of Germany had kind of been responsible for, 700,000 homes were lost during the war. And initially, under Churchill, in the second term of office that he actually had, post-1951, the Tories actually proved very successful at replacing them. There was very much a drive to build for success and build scenarios for that. Now, criticisms include ignoring things like immigration controls, trade union legislation, welfare, education, and so on. But it can't be argued that the Tories did build houses. They even put a plan together for Milton Keynes. Any Milton Keynes folk here? Oh, well, great place, great town. Concrete cities and concrete cows. By 1953, there were some 300,000 new homes that were being built on an annual basis. Although it's fair to say that quality often suffered in that drive for quantity. So let's just build, build, build. Greenbelt, forget it. The 1950s to the 1960s probably saw an unprecedented building boom that actually changed not only the way that Britain actually looked, but also the way that people lived. There were new towns, there were new housing, there were high-rise flats, and there was unprecedented demolition. And that demolition could be said to be problematic. Anybody know what part of London the gateway to the north used to be in? See, lost forever. That wonderful proscenium arch, which effectively connected the whole sort of sequence from that, basically. Euston Station and the arch is what it was. This is what it became. Okay? That's what it was. That's what it became. Have we lost something? Do we prefer the modern? Do we prefer it again? What was behind that? Let's ask that question, why? It's at the heart of this whole thing. Analyse, don't describe. Why is this important? Why is this happening? Well, there was obviously a need for homes for people to live in, so that's fairly important. Otherwise, you're living with a whole range of sort of challenges on that basis. But you also need to accommodate rising traffic. This Gateway to the North picture was taken from 1900. We don't see many horse-drawn carriages going through the streets in the 1940s and 50s. We do see more and more cars coming to the roads and so on. And so you see a big shift in terms of transportation, traffic on the roads and so on. Traffic on the railways, although again, that's an interesting line from that perspective. Also, the great thing about homes, the more houses you build, the more homes you have, the more you can actually charge people rates to live in them, have local taxes and so on. So you can start again getting in more money from the population to actually pay for their own homes and aspects. The image that you saw there was finally demolished in 1963. There were huge protests about why the Euston Station and the Arch should be demolished to make way for Euston Station, the new terminal, etc. But there was a sense of inevitability. Between 1959 and 1975, listed buildings were being demolished at the rate of one a day. Most of those buildings were being demolished for new roads. So, not only was this happening in London, but even Birmingham. The Bullring Centre, effectively seen in the 1930s, here, seen in the aftermath of the Second World War, starting bombing. See now, developing from that. And again, continuing to change. So a lot of building, probably more than in any other century prior to this, was taking place within Britain in particular. The one thing about the Bullring Centre is that it's a suggestion that that effectively the modern way is best, that somehow the way of the car is a way of triumphing over the old world, etc. I've already talked about brutalism being a new concrete architecture which focuses on austerity. But again, this whole notion of building more and more housing for less and less inevitably can have consequences. You can build your national theatres, but what if you're slamming things up to such an extent that, I mean, this was used to be a gate, a listed building. It's actually since been demolished. It was the centrepiece of a movie starring Michael Caine in the 1960s called Get Carter, which some of you might have actually encountered, or not as the case may be. There was a remake with Sylvester Stallone. Try and avoid that if you can. That's my word of advice for you, okay? But at the same time, there were problems. Communities might well have gained roads, they might have gained new schools, new amenities, but there was a sense of loss. There was a loss of community, a loss of identity. A kind of illusion that was predicated by Coronation Street of having a northern town, a northern city, where everybody kind of knew everybody else from that point of view, was developed. And this notion of modernisation, which equates with desolation, was developed. That actually this modernisation in many ways was as bad as bombed out cities. High-rise flats, high-rise accommodations. you kind of see echoes of these kind of issues in the Grenfell tragedy last year. You know, people losing touch and being sort of connected, not connected, disconnected with society, even though, you know, we've got all this fabulous stuff that's actually there. If you remember, we talked about the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. Well, this was another kind of revolution which kind of put paid to the green and pleasant lands that Britain could possibly at one stage have claimed to be. Between 1950 and 1975, motorways alone consumed 25 million acres of agricultural land. Again, a lot of land for a lot of cars. In 1963, the Beeching Report effectively wielded the axe on 5,000 railway stations, which actually meant that the number of railway stations that there were was left at fewer than 2,500, because 5,000 had gone. One of the reasons why you have such kind of problems in terms of commuter traffic in areas like Lincolnshire, for instance, is because actually, there's no point having a rail there. There were over 3,000 miles of railway track that were just abandoned, which also meant that there were 20,000 acres of derelict land. We're actually on what used to be railway derelict land back in the day. Well, at least we built a university on it, apart from the toxic waste, which I think is all gone. But anyway, live dangerously, that's what I say. In other words, you had this modernisation, but also a huge derelict landscape, which in addition to the high-rise flats and the lines from that point of view, still provided a range of areas that were causing problems. This was the 1968 Ronan Point collapse, which, as you can see, effectively resulted in a whole range of problems from basically substandard structural work that was put up there. Because clearly, if you're in the property business and you want to make as much money as possible, you might not pay as much attention to the kind of safety guidelines you should do. Or maybe we'd like this. Maybe we'd like this kind of wasteland, this depressing sort of sense of a derelict landscape of Victorian factories and yards as the economy was switching to this modern manufacturing area, service industries very much to the fore. And again, you're left with over 500,000 ruined and abandoned acres of land, which basically just sat there. What is now effectively the Excel Centre, parts of London, etc., was all for a long period of time just abandoned waste of lands and so on. Finally, just to sort of consider this before I talked about this next gentleman who brings a whole new era to us, some more figures. Between 1947 and 1980, over half of the woods in England were lost. Okay? So if you're looking to hug a tree in the 1950s, 60s or 70s, you'd have to go and start hunting quite a while to actually work through that. And so this strong feeling of decline, failing in housing initiatives, failing in inner city urban life, social conflict and cultural discrimination, which we'll see when we start talking about immigration in a few weeks' time, was very much there. What did this actually result in? Cause and effect? Well, it brought a wave of nostalgia for a past that had been lost. Communities started campaigning to save their buildings. They started campaigning to actually develop green belts, to actually look at areas of outstanding natural beauty. And again, we'll talk a bit more about that as the module develops. But ultimately, in the 1950s, the British people wanted housing, and housing is what they got. In 1953, Winston Churchill suffered a stroke. He struggled on until 1955 as Prime Minister, with the press effectively playing down the gravity of his ill health. But after 6 months in 1955, effectively when he was unfit for office, he retired and was replaced by this gentleman as the ex-Prime Minister of England, Anthony Eden, obviously making use of clearly of the telecommunications, British broadcasting communication that's actually there. Eden was a great statesman. It's generally recognised that he actually did an awful lot of good positive things to keep us on the right side during the Second World War. He had a wartime reputation. He'd served as Foreign Secretary. He had one or two health problems, but primarily the Conservatives as a party remained as popular as ever. And of course, by this stage, Britain were Elizabethans. Queen Elizabeth had been crowned Elizabeth II, and we were into the Elizabethan era. Conservatives as a party remained as strong as ever until in 1956, Suez struck, the Suez Canal, specifically with this gentleman here, Gamal Nasser. And this is a really critical point to sort of acknowledge Britain's place within the world at this stage. It's arguably one of the most important and controversial events in modern British history. Not only did the Suez Crisis result in deep political and public divisions in Britain, it also caused international uproar. So let's look at the background of the Suez Crisis. Well, Egypt was a British protectorate that had gained independence in 1936. You can actually look back a bit further and look at the work of Lawrence of Arabia and how he sort of also paid an impact in terms of this reorganising and changing of areas and maps in the Middle East. But as a British protectorate, it meant that British troops would remain to protect vital interests. One of the critical vital interests was the Suez Canal, which strategically and tactically was ideal for shipping oil from the Middle East directly to Europe and on to Britain through the Mediterranean and so on. In 1954, Colonel Gamal Nasser, you see him there, or the faces of Time magazine, Egypt's premier, he actually became president of Egypt. And Nasser was very much an influential moderniser. He was a nationalist. He was also the first president of the United Arab Republic. Now, bear in mind, in the immediate aftermath of the war, there had also been a settlement and establishment of Israel, the effective eviction of a large number of Palestinians, and a lot of issues which still have echoes and resonances in the 21st century. However, as far as Nasser was concerned, he was looking for allies, he was looking for developing links and so on, and the British and American governments had both reneged on an agreement that they'd actually had in principle with Nasser to help fund the Aswan Dam project in Egypt. One of the reasons they didn't agree to fund the Aswan Dam project was partly because they couldn't afford it. But also, and this is important from the American perspective, because Egypt was buying arms for the Soviet Union, which they also suspected might well be used against Israel as well. So you're beginning to see this notion of what we'll come to look at as proxy wars in a few weeks' time, when we start talking about the ways in which the Cold War is coming to its height, that the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the Soviet Union, and the USA, the United States of America, are effectively two major ideologies, communism and capitalism, effectively battling for the hearts and minds of the globe in many ways. Now, Colonel Nasser responded to that loss of funding quite simply by nationalising the Suez Canal. So effectively, he took full control of the canal for Egypt, by Egypt, and so on. That was seen as unacceptable by Britain, in particular the British government, and so on, and indeed France as well, because both Britain and France relied on the canal for oil supplies. And oil is a massive fuel source that's absolutely essential to work through, and so on. After a lot of international discussion, it was decided that Britain and France would go it alone, and with the backing of Israel, they invaded Egypt. Disaster. Absolute disaster. Eden himself was trying to present himself as a defender of the empire. What we actually got here, 10 years after the Second World War, so still very much in living memory, was a vision of Britain being the aggressor. Britain actually marching into poor little Egypt and effectively taking control, seizing back control of the whole system. The United Nations as a whole condemned the action, and the United States, alarmed by the rise in European aggression and what looked like the old imperialistic outlook. Remember, Britain, start of the 20th century, pretty much ran a third of the world. Now, not so much, far, far less. But this sense that actually we could just march in and sort them out was obviously problematic. And the United States actually threatens to create a currency crisis by effectively demanding immediate repayment of the loans and so on. There were thousands who gathered to protest in Trafalgar Square. Prime Minister Anthony Eden was forced to back down and withdraw his troops. Result, Britain was totally humiliated. The French, needless to say, did pretty little to help as well. Disaster. The Suez Crisis in itself has come to be regarded pretty much as the end of Britain's area or Britain's time as one of the world powers, and also the beginning of the end for the British Empire. Again, sort of photos there from Life magazine in 57, yeah, it should be there. The wrap-up of the astounding war. The notion that actually was there. It just didn't succeed at all. The operation as a whole revealed how weak Britain had actually become. It also revealed how Britain had lost her moral authority to intervene in world affairs. So this whole notion that it kind of managed to progress through its success at the end of the Second World War, the Yalta Conference, where Poland was just one of the countries that was sliced into by Roosevelt, Stalin, Churchill and so on, that notion of actually being one of the key players, forget it. You can't even handle Israel. Ridiculous. It was also seen as immoral because Britain had backed an Arab state or backed against an Arab state by Israel. And it was also seen as it was weak because ultimately it was forced to withdraw. Ultimately, British morale was shattered. Now, we say British morale was shattered. Did that really impact on the person on the street? Not really. But there was a sense that actually in terms of Parliament and the government, it was a big embarrassment. Especially with the rider that happened from America that stated that in future, British foreign policy could only proceed by being agreed upon first with American diplomatic support. So America made it quite clear without any support from America, there was no question of this actually happening ever again. Anthony Eden as Prime Minister at this stage was either ill or exhausted and actually took advantage of an invitation to recuperate in Jamaica, staying at a place called Goldeneye, which was owned by a man called Ian Fleming, who you may recall actually the creator of the wonderful fantasist James Bond. And on his return, on Eden's return in 1957, there were various press headlines such as Prime Minister visits England, and at the end of that, he resigned from office. His successor, Harold Macmillan, tried to set a more cheerful mood. There he is. There. Macmillan basically came up with the catchphrase, "You've never had it so good." And in many ways, actually, that was true. Because in this opening introductory lecture, we move from the immediate 15-year period following the Second World War, from 1945-46, to when this particular image was taken in 1960-61, with, anybody know who this chap is? What's the point to, yes? JFK, yes, John F. Kennedy, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Again, reason I'm keen to sort of stress this is you've got a young, dynamic American president, a slightly more senior British soul, and the way to the future is certainly being pointed. Even in Washington, look at the columns, the white columns, the sort of images that you're actually getting there of the whole Washington. There's kind of emphasis and reinforcement of where the power actually sits, where it lies, and so on and so forth. So what have we actually got at this time as far as Britain's concerned? Well, Britain, by the start of the 60s, was an urbanised, crowded society. 80% of the population would live in cities. The economy was booming. Unemployment was low. Wages were rising. And consumption was rising. So that notion of the American dream that you buy stuff, and if you're still unhappy, buy some more stuff. And if you're still unhappy, buy more stuff to actually deal with the unhappiness of actually buying that stuff in the first place. It was very much there. Cars, domestic appliances, fashion, all were available. That whole notion of actually looking at the American dream, seeing the dream factory in the States, it was becoming more achievable. And it looked, at this particular moment at least, as if the American dream of self-fulfillment through consumption, or consumerism, had actually arrived. And next week we'll be looking at how youth culture and teenage culture was also not only portrayed by the mass media, but also how it also reacted to some of the images that we've actually seen here. Thanks for your time, and I'll see some of you once again in seminar sessions in a few moments.